Just a quick word from our sponsor, Freed. Think about the last time you finished your clinic day or a day in the hospital without a backlog of notes waiting for you. With Freed, that can be your everyday reality. It's not just an AI tool. It's your personal time saver that instantly transcribes and preps a full medical document for you to review. And the backstory of Freed was that it was actually crafted by a computer engineer who watched his physician wife lose her nights and weekends to charting. His solution? An AI that integrates seamlessly into your workflow, understands your needs over time, and most importantly, frees up that precious time. And it's fully HIPAA compliant. With Freed, documentation no longer has to feel like a big lift with a lot of inertia energy. Give it a try and see if it works for your workflow. You get 10 notes for free with Freed. Most people say it saves them 2 hours a day. And after those 10 free notes, it's just $99 a month. It's a small price for a peace of mind and the return of your nighttime and your weekends with your loved ones. As a bonus, CoreAM listeners get 50% off the first month by using the code CORE50. Again, use the code CORE50 to get 50% off your first month with Freed.
Welcome to the second season of Beyond Journal Club, a collaboration between CoreAM and NEJM Group.
The goal of Beyond Journal Club is to take landmark clinical trials and put them into context, telling the story of how we got to where we are and what it means for how we take care of our patients.
I'm Dr. Sue Ellen Lee, a former editorial fellow at the New England Journal of Medicine and a hospitalist at MGH.
I'm Dr. Greg Katz, cardiologist at NYU.
And I'm Dr. Clem Lee, also a former fellow and a current guest editor at the New England Journal of Medicine.
Today we're talking about the MINT trial, which stands for myocardial ischemia and transfusion. MINT was published in the New England Journal of Medicine in November of 2023.
MINT was a big trial looking at transfusion thresholds in patients with anemia and acute myocardial infarction, what will be referred to from now on as MI.
When MINT came out, all I could think about was how surprised I was. I was surprised that somebody thought this trial was worth doing. I was surprised they got the money to do it. And then when I read the results, I was even more surprised about what they showed.
Yeah, I was pretty surprised too, Greg. So to help us understand MINT today, we are going to first get into the story of what the prior transfusion trials had told us.
Then we'll talk about the pathophysiology of anemia and why it might be uniquely harmful in the setting of an acute MI.
And finally, we'll deep dive into the MINT trial to try and answer the question of whether patients who are having heart attacks really should have a different threshold for blood transfusions. For a long time, the standard for transfusion was something called the 10-30 rule, which was to transfuse for a hemoglobin of 10 or a hematocrit of 30. So where does this dogma that we write in our notes all the time, transfuse to a hemoglobin of 7 grams per deciliter, come from?
The biggest reason why we've transformed from the 10-30 rule to transfuse to a goal of 7 really probably starts with the TRIC trial, which was published in the New England Journal of Medicine in 1999. The TRIC trial randomized critically ill patients in the ICU to get a transfusion when the hemoglobin drops below 7, which was considered a restrictive protocol, versus a transfusion when the hemoglobin dropped below 10, which was considered a liberal transfusion strategy. Then TRIC compared their 30-day all-cause mortality.
Yeah, TRIC was a groundbreaking trial that changed practice for many doctors. I remember talking about it during ICU rounds. The results were that it showed that 30-day mortality was similar in the two groups.
And when you dig into the details, it seems that a restrictive strategy isn't just neutral, but there's a suggestion that transfusing at lower hemoglobin thresholds might actually be better than a liberal strategy.
Right. In the subgroup analysis of TRIC, those with cardiac disease had similar mortality whether transfused with a liberal or restrictive strategy. So the TRIC investigators concluded that critically ill patients should be transfused for a hemoglobin threshold of 7. But because they didn't enroll any patients with active coronary ischemia, they noted that population might be an exception.
And then after this study, over the next 2 decades, there was study after study looking at transfusion thresholds in so many different populations. And all of these trials essentially found the same thing. Restrictive thresholds are non-inferior and may even be superior to liberal transfusion thresholds.
And to Greg's point, those results were replicated in patients undergoing cardiac surgery and even in patients who were having active GI bleeds.
The idea that a restrictive transfusion strategy and an acute GI bleed makes sense. For me, it's totally counterintuitive.
Right. Talk about another surprising finding. And I remember this trial well because my attending during medical school quizzed me on it on rounds. And this was the Villanueva trial, which was published in the New England Journal in 2013. They randomized patients with severe acute upper GI bleeding to either restrictive transfusion threshold of 7 grams per deciliter or a liberal threshold of 9.
I would have thought that giving more blood to people who are actively bleeding would make their outcomes better. But the restrictive strategy in this case was associated with a 45% reduction in all-cause mortality and also even a reduced rate of rebleeding.
Yeah, it turns out that more blood transfusions actually increases the portal pressure, and that causes more rebleeding. So this was pretty convincing evidence that a lower hemoglobin threshold of 7 was appropriate, even in patients with an acute GI bleed.
And so the consistency of this transfusion data led to a complete paradigm shift in clinical medicine. And when you start to think about it, it makes sense why a restrictive strategy might be non-inferior or even better. Blood transfusion is not a benign procedure.
Yeah, I think many of us have had to consent patients for blood, and we all know these risks. There are risks of infection, transfusion reactions, volume overload, clots, formation of new antibodies, and even rarely graft versus host disease.
Yeah, and this reminds me of a patient of mine who was chronically anemic with a baseline hemoglobin around 7. And on the day of discharge, his hemoglobin dropped to 6.9. So we went back and forth on rounds about whether or not to transfuse him and ultimately gave him a unit of RBCs to tank him up before he left and chased it with some IV furosemide. And that same evening, not even the next day, I got a notification that he had been readmitted for volume overload.
Oh, that's tough. I feel like those readmission notifications always get me and make me wonder if I did any harm to my patient or maybe if I caused that readmission.
Yeah.
So, you know, we're all doing our best in those challenging cases, but it is true that blood transfusions come with real potential harms. And now we have multiple studies demonstrating more isn't always better and it might even be worse.
So just to recap the trials that we talked about blood transfusions, we started with the TRIC trial, which surprised people initially that the lower thresholds might be okay in critically ill patients. And then tons of other studies, including in the GI world with the Villanueva study, show that lower thresholds were equal or better.
Right. That's the same information that Dr. Jeff Carson, the lead investigator of the MINT trial, was going off of.
I think everyone was leaning towards a restrictive transfusion approach across all groups of patients, right? And it wasn't unreasonable given that all the trial after trial. So if you look at all the major trials that have been published in the Journal of Medicine, right? And every one of those trials said less blood is as safe. So, you know, the presumption was, well, that's going to be the same in patients with underlying myocardial infarction.
Yep. So the assumption was that patients with myocardial infarctions would also benefit from transfusing only when a hemoglobin reached a lower restrictive threshold, but we didn't know for sure and we didn't have evidence of it.
So what's our level of confidence that we can extrapolate this data from ICU patients, patients going for cardiac surgery, and patients who are having GI bleeds to a group of patients who are having heart attacks? And so it might be worth taking a quick look at the pathophysiology of an acute MI and think about why anemia in this setting might be a little bit different than anemia when it happens in other cases. If you think about the pathophysiology, you can make a pretty compelling argument for why we should think about transfusing heart attack patients differently than other patients.
Okay, I feel like, of course, the cardiologist is going to try to convince us that the heart is more special than the other organs.
Before you just dismiss me, at least hear my case. And so the primary problem with a heart attack is different than the primary problem in all of these other conditions. The primary issue in acute MI is a lack of oxygen delivery to the heart muscle. And so that's different from sepsis with inappropriate vasodilation or a GI bleed where you're losing blood or any other ICU condition. This is a different process. And the follow-up to that is that if your anemia is making your oxygen delivery worse, that's going to increase the size of the MI and lead to a higher risk of heart failure, mechanical complications, and arrhythmias. There are a million reasons why the anemia is making that primary problem of oxygen delivery to the myocardium worse. And maybe the patient with an ischemic myocardium doesn't fit into all of those other groups.
Well, is there any clinical data to back that up? Or are you just biased about the heart? You know, it did make theoretical sense to give blood in GI bleeding, but you know that that didn't pan out.
Oof.
So actually, yeah, we do have real data to back this up. In 1998, there was a study published in JAMA using 32 healthy young volunteers where the researchers took out their blood and replaced it with albumin or plasma until they reached a hemoglobin of 5 grams per deciliter from a baseline of about 13.
So, Ellen, I appreciate you defending me with Clem's skepticism. So what's shocking about this study, besides the fact that it got past an IRB, is that at rest, patients who had a hemoglobin of 5 didn't have any evidence of inadequate oxygenation or perfusion. They all had normal O2 saturations and lactate levels.
But here's the kicker. 2 patients in that study with normal coronaries developed ST changes with activity.
An ST change with activity tells me that even a young, healthy person can have ischemia provoked by a low hemoglobin. This means that significant enough anemia can make you fail a stress test, even if your coronary arteries are normal.
But most of our patients in the hospital are not healthy volunteers. And when you think about patients with heart disease, even milder anemia could have potentially serious myocardial consequences.
Right. And just to be explicit, when you think about an acute MI, there's an occlusion of a coronary artery that's decreasing blood flow to the heart. You throw some anemia on top of that, and it makes the myocardial ischemia that much worse.
So the anemia here is kind of like a snowball effect, but in a bad direction. Anemia increases myocardial ischemia, which reduces the heart's ability to compensate for a low hemoglobin, which just further worsens oxygen delivery, and the process just spirals.
And so we cardiologists might be biased about the heart being special, but this is the reason why guidelines have historically recommended higher transfusion thresholds in patients who have cardiovascular disease, 8 grams per deciliter compared to 7.
Well, like I said, the theoretical pathophysiology doesn't matter if the trials don't back up that hypothesis. So what have the data shown and not shown in the world of transfusions and MIs?
As they say, the road to hell is paved with biological plausibility. As we were talking about before, patients having active MIs have historically not been part of transfusion trials. And so even though we have all of these theories about the pathophysiology, until recently, we haven't had any hard outcomes data to give us a sense of how these patients do when they're anemic.
So the seeds for the MINT trial were actually planted more than 2 decades ago, before the TRIC trial was even published.
Which is pretty impressive, considering I plant MINT seeds every summer, and they really never last past the fall for me.
Well, I think we're all glad you're a doctor and not a farmer, Clem. And we got to talk to Dr. Jeffrey Carson about where he got the idea for all of this and why he's been thinking about this topic for the last 2 decades.
We had done a long time ago a study in patients of the Jehovah's Witness faith in which we looked at 2,000 or so of those who underwent an operation in the operating room. It's an observational study. And what we found was an interaction with cardiovascular disease. That is, patients were more likely to die as their hemoglobin fell in patients with cardiovascular disease than those without cardiovascular disease. And that mortality stepped up around the often criticized 10-gram threshold. So we had some observational data that this group might be at risk.
So in these surgical patients with cardiac disease who had declined blood transfusion, he actually found that the lower the pre-op hemoglobin level, the higher their operative mortality.
And this led to several other observational studies in patients with acute coronary syndrome.
For example, there was a study in Circulation in 2005 that had a signal that patients who were having STEMIs who had a hemoglobin level below 14 had a higher mortality. And likewise, in patients with NSTEMI, a hemoglobin below 11 was associated with higher CV mortality.
I'll try to stay off my full observational data soapbox, but we need to remind everyone that a cohort study like that never proves anything causal. It just provides data that we can use to help develop a hypothesis which can be tested in a randomized trial.
Exactly. And in the symptomatic coronary artery disease population, randomized trial data were essentially absent. That was until Dr. Carson and his colleagues performed a pilot trial in 2013.
We did a pilot study, also funded by NIH a number of years ago, where we enrolled 110 patients in that pilot. And lo and behold, we had 7 deaths in the lower group, in the restrictive group, and 1 death in the liberal group. So, like, holy mackerels, maybe we have really something going on here.
So now we have more data that maybe cardiac patients are different, and a liberal approach to blood transfusions could be better in this population.
Yeah, and then came along the first large major randomized trial in this area, the REALITY trial, published in JAMA in 2021. The researchers of REALITY randomized 668 patients with MI and anemia to a restrictive threshold of 8 or liberal threshold of 10 grams per deciliter.
The results of REALITY were totally consistent with all that other prior randomized data, and they didn't support that observational data we had on acute MI patients. REALITY showed that a restrictive threshold of transfusing to a hemoglobin of 8 was not inferior to a liberal threshold of transfusing to a hemoglobin of 10.
So maybe the REALITY trial gave us a reality check.
Nice. It's hard to...
Good one. Yeah.
It's hard to think of a small trial like REALITY with under 700 patients as the last word on the topic.
Yeah, and that brings us to the MINT trial.
So the MINT trial randomized 3,504 patients. That's five times as many patients as in the REALITY trial, with myocardial infarction and a hemoglobin less than 10 to either a restrictive or liberal transfusion threshold.
Yeah, and just looking at these patients, they feel very similar to the ones I commonly see in the hospital. The mean age of these patients was about 72 years old, 45% of them were female, about half had CKD, and about a third had a history of heart failure, percutaneous coronary intervention, or MI.
And I'll also point out that the vast majority of these patients had an NSTEMI as opposed to having ST segments that were elevated.
And the MINT investigators took all of these patients who presented with all different types of acute MI and randomized them to either a liberal transfusion threshold of 10 grams per deciliter or a restrictive threshold, which was transfusing to a hemoglobin of either 7 or 8.
That threshold of either 7 or 8 feels confusing, and so let's dig into the details. At a hemoglobin of 8, transfusion was permitted but wasn't required, and at a hemoglobin of 7, it was strongly recommended. It was also strongly recommended to transfuse if patients had angina that was not well controlled with medications.
And in the liberal group, all of the patients were transfused one unit at a time to achieve a hemoglobin level above 10.
And by day one, we already saw a difference between the groups. The liberal strategy had an average hemoglobin of 10.1, and the restrictive group had an average hemoglobin level of 8.8.
The primary outcome was MI or death at 30 days.
So Ellen, do you want to do the honor of sharing with us the results?
I would love to, Greg. If you want to be literal about it, the results of the trial were neutral.
Yeah, but if you look into it, Sue Ellen, surprisingly, an MI or death occurred more in the restrictive transfusion arm. To be exact, 17% of the patients in the restrictive arm had a death or MI versus 15% of the patients in the liberal group, giving us a p-value of 0.07.
So we have a confidence interval that barely crosses one with a p-value that's just a bit over that magical 0.05 that we usually look for. And so we usually are pretty strict about these p-values, but I frequently find myself coming back to the idea that the p-value cutoff that we use is kind of arbitrary. I mean, is 0.07 truly different than 0.05?
So rather than get into an existential argument about the nature of p-values, why don't we dig into the results a bit more so we can actually understand what's happening in the trial rather than just the top line result?
Sure, Sue Ellen. Four big things stand out to me. First, these interventions were not blinded, right? The restrictive group didn't get sham transfusions.
That's true, but I think of unblinding as being really important when we're looking at soft outcomes that are subject to the placebo effect. But the primary outcome in MINT was a composite of centrally adjudicated MI and cardiac death, neither of which are variables that I consider to be subject to the placebo effect.
Okay, that's a fair point. The second thing is that MI patients with anemia might be less likely to receive aggressive antithrombotic treatments or to go for invasive cardiac procedures. So I wonder if that's a possible confounder there.
Great point, but I doubt it because the rates of PCI and cath were actually similar between the two groups.
But I really like where you're going with thinking about the way anemia interacts with the medical therapy for coronary disease. This could be a huge confounder in the observational data. In other words, did that patient with a lower hemoglobin do worse because they were anemic and they suffered the effects of end-organ hypoxemia? Or was it because the anemia made us less likely to give them dual antiplatelet therapy and take them to the cath lab?
I wondered about that too, Greg. And the third thing to consider is the side effects in each arm. The rates of protocol discontinuation were much higher in the liberal group compared to the restrictive group. There was actually a fivefold difference.
It's really notable that almost 14% of patients assigned to the liberal transfusion strategy discontinued this protocol. That's more than 1 in 8 patients.
Right, that's a lot of patients. And when we think of why, it's because some in the liberal group discontinued from adverse effects like fluid overload or transfusion reactions.
Unsurprisingly, the rates of TACO, or transfusion-associated circulatory overload, were lower in the restrictive group compared to the liberal group. But oddly, the rates of heart failure were similar.
Talk about a surprising finding. I can't believe I made that joke. But in all seriousness, some others discontinued the transfusion protocol in the liberal arm, either because of blood supply shortages or just simply because of patient and clinician preference.
I mean, we've been told for years that a restrictive strategy is better, so I see why some clinicians might balk at the idea of transfusing patients to a hemoglobin of 10.
Yeah, I agree. I think I personally probably would have also hesitated. Okay, so the last and maybe most relevant point to me as a generalist is that a majority of these patients had a type 2 MI, 56%, whereas only 42% had a type 1 MI.
The different terms for MIs kind of get thrown around and can get confusing, so let's just take a second to discuss what it actually means to have an MI.
So to meet the universal definition of myocardial infarction, you need to have a troponin elevation plus either symptoms, EKG changes, or wall motion abnormalities on echo. So just a little bit of a troponin leak does not mean you're having a heart attack. You need something else clinical to make that case.
Yeah, and that universal definition of MI is a catch-all term. It actually doesn't tell us anything about which type of MI it is.
The MIT investigators included most types of MI, so this included patients with both type 1 and type 2 MIs, and also type 4B and 4C.
And just to be on the same page, a type 1 MI is a coronary occlusion from a ruptured atherosclerotic plaque. The type 2 MI is related to supply-demand mismatch. Type 4B and 4C are MIs related to stent thrombosis or in-stent restenosis.
And to be even more confusing, the type of MI has nothing to do with whether the ST segments are up or not.
Oof. Well, with that in mind, if you look at the subgroup that had a type 1 MI, aka a coronary occlusion, the liberal strategy to transfuse to a hemoglobin of 10 was actually superior than restricting those patients to a hemoglobin of 7 or 8.
And patients with type 1 MIs are often very different than patients who have type 2 MIs. The type 2 MI group is far more heterogeneous. I mean, what proportion of all comers to the ICU don't have shortness of breath or chest pain along with an elevated troponin? I mean, you could even go so far as to argue that these type 2 MI patients are essentially just less sick trick trial patients, meaning all comers who are sick and in the hospital.
Right. It kind of makes you wonder if this trial had only enrolled type 1 MI patients and not all the heterogeneous type 2 MI patients, maybe the overall primary endpoint might have been significantly different between the groups.
Right. So we sat down with Dr. Sunil Rao to ask why they enrolled patients with both type 1 and type 2 MI. Dr. Rao is the director of interventional cardiology at NYU and one of the investigators on the MIT trial.
We felt that type 2 MI is an important understudied population. Obviously, anemia has been implicated as a cause of type 2 MI. From a practical clinical trialist standpoint, you know, this is not a traditional, you know, industry-funded drug A versus drug B acute coronary syndrome trial. These patients were really sick. If you think about the patients in the hospital now who are hospitalized with acute MI who have anemia, think about all their other comorbid conditions. They tend to be much, much older. They have a lot of end-stage renal disease or CKD. These are patients that traditionally are not approached for ACS trials, right? So it is challenging, and it was challenging to enroll in this trial. So we felt that if we could broaden the inclusion criteria, it would make the trial a little bit more feasible to enroll in.
That's fair. We do see a lot of patients with type 2 MIs, and it would be really helpful to have a sense of whether they would benefit from a higher transfusion threshold.
Yeah, it sounds like the investigators did their best to make this a pragmatic trial that could attract as many patients to enroll as possible. Unfortunately, they overestimated how many MIs the patients were going to have, so the fact that there were fewer MIs might be one of the explanations why the p-value was 0.07 and not 0.05.
So let's take a minute to summarize the MIT trial. At face value, this was a neutral trial. There was no difference in death or MI at 1 month after transfusing to a hemoglobin level of 7 or 8 versus 10 for patients with MIs and anemia. But the p-value barely missed significance and the confidence interval barely crossed 1. So there's an argument to be made that this was actually a positive trial.
And the most interesting to me was a subgroup analysis. Patients with type 1 MI did do better with a liberal strategy, transfusing to a hemoglobin of 10 grams per deciliter.
So where does this leave us? Will the MIT trial change your practice? Are you going to be more liberal with your transfusion threshold for patients with MI?
Yes, Suellen, I think there's two questions there. The first one is a standalone question about whether that p-value of 0.07 is a problem for us and whether we should consider this a positive trial.
Right. And one of the statisticians even did a calculation that just a single additional patient reaching the endpoint in the restrictive arm would have made the p-value 0.05.
Yeah, but then again, on the other hand, if there was one more event in the liberal group, that would have made it even more neutral.
And also remember, when you're thinking about applying this liberal strategy to your patients, almost 14% of the people in that liberal group ultimately didn't follow the protocol to transfuse to a hemoglobin of 10. And so if those patients had followed the protocol literally, the results might have been very different. We really just don't know.
You know, it's really a reminder of how fragile some of these trial results can be, especially when there are low event rates across relatively small groups of patients.
Exactly. And that leads us to the second question that you asked, Suellen, which is how to put the results of the MIT trial in the context of the body of literature, which up until now had basically favored restricting blood transfusions to a lower threshold.
The degree to which any one trial persuades us to change our practice is going to be necessarily based on our pre-trial expectations. This is no different than using the concept of a pretest probability when we interpret a diagnostic study. most doctors incorporate their pre-trial expectation in the way that we interpret and integrate a new trial into our practice.
Yeah, what Greg is referring to is called a Bayesian analysis when it's done statistically, and what your pretrial probability was, and in this case, how skeptical you were about liberal transfusions, those things ultimately affect how you interpret the results of the MINT trial.
That type of analysis was in one of the published letters to the editor, a Bayesian analysis to understand how the results of MINT would influence your thinking based on your pretrial probability. Everyone I talked to about this trial brought up that letter to the editor when they were thinking about the interpretation. The authors there suggested that even if you went in with a skeptical pretrial probability that liberal transfusions were beneficial, when you analyze the results through a Bayesian lens, there's still a strong chance that the results of MINT tell us that a liberal transfusion strategy is beneficial for an acute MI population.
Wow, really? But I mean, all the other trials show that liberal wasn't better, and this trial technically, on face value, was neutral too. So putting that all together, how would this one trial persuade us to be more liberal about transfusions?
The MINT trial wasn't as definitive as we would have hoped, but I do think that if you look at it from the 10,000-foot view, from a practical clinician point of view, strong consideration should be given to transfusing that type 1 MI patient to a hemoglobin of 10. Because, again, all the point estimates favored that strategy. The cardiac death favored that strategy. I was very, very conservative with transfusion because of all the data to date. But now I think with the MINT trial, which is the largest randomized trial ever done in this population, it's 3,500 patients, it really does suggest, and note I'm not saying it proves, it suggests that there is a benefit with more aggressive transfusion.
You know, I have to say, I think this is what makes clinical research imperfect, but also so interesting. You have this very thoughtfully designed and conducted trial, and yet at the end of the day, different people may interpret the results in different ways. So what do you guys think we are meant to take away from this trial?
Other than the fact that perhaps we shouldn't be letting you attempt to write puns, Sue Ellen?
Ouch, Clem. I'm trying my best here.
touche, we all are. I do think I'll be more thoughtful about my patients who are having an MI when I'm thinking about whether to transfuse to a goal of 7 or 10 grams per deciliter.
I actually saw that after the MINT trial was published, UpToDate now recommends considering transfusing to a hemoglobin of 10 in patients with acute MI.
Yeah, I saw that too. I mean, they didn't really specify the type of MI, but they said to consider this in patients with, quote, unstable MI or stable MI with risk factors, and those risk factors included incomplete revascularization or high-risk anatomy.
And when we asked Dr. Carson about this, he said that in his view, a hemoglobin of 7 or 8 should be avoided for all patients with acute MIs. So basically transfuse if a patient with an MI has a hemoglobin of, for example, 7.5.
So, you know, I understand that perspective, but I don't agree with it.
You don't?
No, I don't think it's fair to say that we should be blindly transfusing every anemic patient with an acute MI to a somewhat arbitrary hemoglobin target. But I do think it's fair to say that ultimately the data from MINT are really persuasive to the idea that there's a subset of patients with acute MIs who are doing worse because of their anemia. And we should be correcting the problem for those patients with transfusion.
Yeah, so we should not be transfusing every patient with an MI who has anemia to a hemoglobin goal of 10. We should be individualizing our threshold for each patient. You know, it's a bloody difficult task, but this trial is bringing us closer to an answer.
The other thing that we have an answer to is whether you should be making puns for the rest of the episode, and the answer is probably no. But our job here is to figure out who's ischemic because of their anemia. Are they having chest pain? Do they have ST depressions? That's the patient who needs a higher transfusion target. Our job as doctors is to figure out which of our patients are doing worse because of their anemia and thus are going to benefit from being more liberal with our approach to blood transfusions.
That point about treating the patient in front of you is so important. I mean, if your patient develops volume overload or a febrile transfusion reaction, you don't need to blindly transfuse to a target of 10 just because the MINT trial suggested that you should.
Yeah, I'm pretty curious to see how the results of MINT end up changing clinical practice and guidelines and to see whether that transfusion pendulum will start to swing.
Yeah, this trial has so many implications. If we were to shift practice, what would that mean, for example, for the blood supply and the shortages?
Now, I'm not too nervous about it because, remember, it took the British Navy 200 years to put limes on their ships to prevent scurvy. So we're still within that 200-year time frame. I'm hopeful that practice will change a little faster than that, though.
Well, I would certainly hope so. And on that note, it's a wrap on this episode of Beyond Journal Club.
If you found this episode helpful, please share it with your team and colleagues and give it a rating on Apple Podcasts or whatever podcast app you use. It really does help people find us.
And if you have any feedback, please email us at hello@coreiampodcast.com. Opinions expressed are our own and do not represent the opinions of any affiliated institutions. I'm going to hate myself for making this joke, but talk about a surprising finding.
Oh, no.
That's fair.
And so as we were talking about before, patients having acute MIs have historically been excluded. And so, as we were talking about above, or, okay, yeah. And so,
No, that's, that I wasn't sure how, yeah, if that was like a clap back at Greg, but okay. Rather than just get into an argument about the meat, okay.
Bellen.
Ouch, Clem. I'm trying.
Touche. Yeah, I do think it'll be. I'll be.
At Kroger Pharmacy, CARE is making it easy to get vaccinated. CARE is helping you stay protected from flu, COVID, and RSV. Seasonal vaccines are available 7 days a week with evening hours. CARE is giving you a shot at staying healthy this season. Walk in whenever is best and get multiple vaccines in one visit at your local Kroger Pharmacy. So come and get the protection you need while protecting those around you. Kroger Health, a world of care, is in store. Visit Kroger.com/vaccines for more. Restrictions and exclusions apply. See site for details.